Our scripture reading is one that you all know, that we've already said once before. So if you join me again as we read the Lord's Prayer, which is Matthew 6, 9 through 13. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen. What an honor and joy it is to be here. Now, they told me the typical sermon time is about 2-3 hours. Is that about right? Good. Well, it is truly just a blessing to come to this beautiful place and to see, hear its history and get to know some folks who've been coming here for several generations. It's truly, I didn't know a place like this existed, and it's wonderful to be here. So my topic, I do a lot of writing, as Melody said, about the Jewishness of Jesus. And one of the most interesting parts of the New Testament that's really rooted in the Old Testament is the Lord's Prayer. And it is, I do a lot of interfaith weddings. And oftentimes at an interfaith wedding, we'll read the Lord's Prayer. And I've had some Jewish families who say to me, we're not so comfortable with the Lord's Prayer being said at a wedding. And I understand why, because it's often associated with a church. But as I began to investigate the issue, it really is as much of a Jewish prayer as it is a Christian prayer. And the reason is that it's really rooted. If you look deeper behind the language, you see so many echoes of Jewish literature, of the Hebrew Bible, and of what Jewish scholars call Midrash. Midrash is interpretation of the text. So Midrash is the kind of, you know, if a biblical scholar will say, well, who did Cain and Abel marry if Adam and Eve were the first people on earth? Midrash is what gives you the answers to those kinds of questions. So it's interpretations of the Bible. And the Lord's Prayer, behind its words, we can see so much Midrash, history, and really a deeper spirituality. So I want to go through the Lord's Prayer verse by verse so that next time we say it, we can see its deeper message. So we know the first verse, our Father who art in heaven. Now, our Father, that is oftentimes scholars have thought that one of the innovations that Jesus introduced was picturing God as a father rather than as a sort of transcendent, distant figure. But the truth is, the notion of God as a father, as a personal, that we have a personal relationship with God, is deeply rooted in Jewish tradition. In the book of Exodus, you have God refer to Israel as my firstborn son. So you have this notion of a father-son relationship. And why that's so important is it introduces a new dimension into God's love, right? We use the word love, which is what I'm going to talk about this evening, the meaning of love, but we use love in so many different ways, right? I mean, we can sign an email to a friend, love, you know, Evan, or we can say, I love that band, right? We use love so much, but the deepest kind of love is that parental love, the filial love. And in this prayer, Jesus introduces, drawing from Jewish tradition, the notion of parental love into our relationship with God. And that's very deep and very profound to call God Father. And it is, it's an innovation, but it's an innovation that's built on what was already there in Jewish tradition. Now, the understanding of who art in heaven. Now, this is a very interesting. In Judaism, the word for heaven is Shemayim. And Shemayim can mean something that's up here, but can also mean what we do here on earth. So our Father who art in heaven can also mean our Father who we bring into this earth. It's very, it's malchut, the Hebrew phrase is shamayim, but there's also malchut shamayim, God's divinity on earth. So this is both looking upward to God as we think about it, and it's also looking around. Now the next verse, hallowed be thy name. This is probably the most or the most deeply rooted in Jewish tradition. There's a prayer in Judaism. If you've ever been to a Jewish funeral, you've probably heard this prayer known as the Kaddish. And the Kaddish is all about glorifying God's name. See, God's name is another way of saying God's reputation. In a sense, we hold up God's name, God's will, here on earth through what we say. And the notion of God's name is found throughout Jewish tradition. And the idea is that God's name is tied up with God's people. So how we behave on earth reflects on God's will and God's reputation. And it's tremendously, it's all over Jewish liturgy. So Jesus was drawing from this rich understanding of Jewish tradition when he was teaching his disciples this prayer. And he was saying, act in a way that reflects my name, my nature, my values here on earth. And then we get to thy kingdom come. Now this is another phrase that we see throughout both the New Testament and the Old Testament. And it is, we just sang a hymn before I came up here, this hymn, which was so beautiful, for the healing of nations. And if you want to think about thy kingdom come, what does it look like when Jesus' kingdom comes, or when God's kingdom comes? It's just like what we sang in the psalm, a sense of peace. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, nor shall they study war no more. So this is an idea that we are looking, it's in Judaism, it's called messianism. We're looking towards the future. We're looking towards what will happen. And at this point, this also introduces a political dimension. I'm not going to talk politics, thankfully, but it introduces a political dimension into this prayer. So when Jesus was teaching, Caesar ruled what was then known as Judea and the Galilee and the Roman Empire. And there was relentless persecution. There was relentless persecution of Jews, especially, and there were relentless persecution of others. And Jesus is saying, your kingdom, Caesar is not my king. Caesar may be my king on a practical level, but I'm looking towards God's kingdom, that there's a higher power that we serve, not just the Caesar who is the king here on earth, but thy kingdom come. So Jesus is looking towards the time when we won't be ruled by malicious persecution coming from Rome, but from God's kingdom. So it's a vision of another world. In a way, it's kind of from a political, Jesus is lifting the prayer, lifting his disciples from a political realm to a spiritual realm. And then we get to thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. In this phrase, Jesus is he's hinting at a major debate that existed within the Jewish community of this time. And the debate was between a group known as the Pharisees and a group known as the Sadducees. Now, the Pharisees are often given a bad reputation in the Gospels, which is not really fair. And if you want to know why, you can read my book. But it's a subject for another talk. But the Pharisees believed in life after death. They believed that this world was simply the vestibule towards the world to come. Now, of course, this is an idea taken up within Christianity. The Sadducees, who were closely aligned with Rome, the Sadducees were the aristocrats. They were the ones whose salary was paid for by the Roman government. They were the elites. And they believed that everything happened on this earth, and they didn't believe there was a world to come. So this is, Jesus is hinting that there is more than this world. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Now, we can bring that, our aim is to bring what is in heaven down to earth. But Jesus is saying, in a sense, Jesus is saying, I'm siding with the Pharisees. I'm siding with the idea that there is a life outside of this world. So very, very powerful, but hinting at it in a subtle way. And the idea of thy will, God's ratzon, God's will, the Hebrew word is ratzon, bringing that down into earth. Then we get to give us this day our daily bread. Now, if you think about that phrase carefully, there's a redundancy in it. Give us this day our daily bread. Why not just say, give us this day our bread? Or give us our daily bread. You don't need this day and daily. Now, in Jewish tradition, every word of the Bible has significance. Every single dot, every single vowel, everything has divine significance. So, looking at this prayer, we have to say, give us this day our daily bread. Why the repetition? And the answer is very interesting. In the wilderness, on the sixth day of the week, before the Sabbath, which was the seventh day, God would give the Israelites a double portion of manna. So the double portion was meant to satisfy the Israelites through Sabbath so that they didn't have to go out and get food on the Sabbath. So in a way, Jesus is echoing that miracle of God providing manna in the wilderness for the Israelites. Jesus is saying God will provide for us as well. It's both a echo and a prediction. And in addition, one of the interesting things about the manna, and this is where Midrash comes in, the Midrash says every person got the exact amount of manna that they needed. So if you had a family of 10 people, you got enough manna to feed your family of 10. If it was just you and your wife, you got enough to feed the two of you. Manna was a miracle in that God provided exactly as we need. So Jesus is saying that's what will happen in the future. That's where we will go. And they were in the wilderness as well. So this is the manna was provided in the wilderness, and the disciples, as Jesus was preaching, if you've been to where the Sermon on the Mount was delivered, it is in the wilderness. Now the next verse, some of you, if you've been in other churches, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass on us. There's another translation that's often used for trespass. Debts, right? Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Now, this is interesting. So scholars are uncertain which version is older and which is the more authentic. But in some ways, debt is the more powerful word in that it can feel a little jarring, right? We're going from thinking about our daily nourishment, bread, to thinking about banks, right? But the notion of debt was very important in ancient Israel. Every seventh year, the sabbatical year, debts were forgiven because the writers of the Bible or God knew that debts would be very crippling. You know, just they can be today. And they were even worse. There wasn't a concept of bankruptcy in ancient Israel. You couldn't declare bankruptcy and get your debts erased. A debt could permanently harm a family and push them away from their tribal inheritance. So debt was very dangerous. So in some ways, Jesus is advocating a notion of restorative righteousness, that at a certain point, the debts that we have here on earth shouldn't totally destroy us. Now, he's not arguing for a total elimination of debts, but it's an idea of forgiveness, that the debts that we accrue, the losses that we experience, don't undermine our humanity. And at some points, there should be an element of forgiveness. And that was built into Jewish law with the sabbatical year. So every seventh year, all debts were forgiven. Now, if there are any bankers in the room here, you know that would be a very bad for an economy if every seventh year debts were forgiven, because then no one would give loans, right? If you knew they were going to be gone 7 years, you wouldn't give a loan. So there were tools that helped balance the economy, but the idea was that we should never permanently be indebted, that that's not how God intended us to be. Now we get towards the end, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Now, we have to look a little bit deeper at this verse because it's more complex than it seems at the surface. Lead us not into temptation. That seems like a pretty normal call. Stop us from doing bad things, God. We don't want to be tempted. But it's actually something much deeper. It's actually saying, what Jesus is saying is, God, don't put us to the test. Don't tempt us with being, so if you, to understand it, we have to go back to the Akedah, which is where God says to Abraham, take your son, your only son, and offer him as a sacrifice on the mountain. God is testing Abraham. And then later on, in earlier in the book of Matthew, there's the test in the wilderness where God shows Jesus all the wealth of the world and says, this can all be yours, right? And Jesus says, no. So Jesus is saying, don't put us to this kind of test. We don't want, don't constantly challenge us, because this was constantly something that Jews of that period face. There were lots of martyrs. The Roman Empire was constantly tempting Jews, saying, hey, if you inform on your fellow Israelites, if you inform on your fellow Jews, we'll give you, you know, you'll be appointed somewhere in Herod's court. So Jesus is saying, you'll have to withstand these tests of faith, but God, we don't want to have to constantly test our faith. We don't want to be put into this situation all the time. So it's not just a prayer saying, we don't want to be tempted by bad things. It's saying, don't put us into these extremely difficult circumstances. So it's very human, right? Who wants to be tested all the time? And then deliver us from evil. So in Judaism, evil would be known as the adversary. If you've read the book of Job, right, you know that Job, this person known as the adversary, tests God or wants God to test Job. So again, this is saying, don't make our life of faith extremely difficult, right? We don't want to have to suffer. Now, there are some strands in both Judaism and Christianity where suffering is a good thing, right? That it's, you know, the suffering servant. But Jesus is saying a very human thing here. We don't want to have to suffer. We don't want to constantly be tempted. We don't want to constantly be tested by our faith. Don't bring us there, God. And then, of course, we get to the end, which is also known as the doxology, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. Now, the interesting thing is, this ending is not found in some of the original manuscripts of the Bible. So it might have been added later. And it makes sense, right? So the prayer up until this point is very personal. And then we get to this sort of religious language, you know, for thine is the kingdom, the power, the glory. But what it's kind of wrapping it all together. It's saying, you know, God, this all belongs to you, and it's within your power to help guide us through life. It's within your power. So if we take a big look back and say, what's so powerful about this prayer? I mean, everyone here knew it by heart. I'm a rabbi, and I knew it by heart. So, you know, this prayer illustrates something deeply powerful. And that's why it's neither Jewish nor Christian, really. The most powerful prayers speak to our most basic human concerns, our deepest needs as human beings. Think of the Serenity Prayer, right? Which you know, Reinhold Niebuhr wrote. And think of other prayers that really just everybody knows because they so speak so deeply to human concerns. And I think that's what we're seeing here in the Lord's Prayer. We're seeing Jesus, what was so extraordinary. So Jesus takes these Jewish ideas and summarizes them in this extraordinary prayer. And we get a real feeling of both connection and humanity. And it's also a message for how to live, that we magnify God's power, thy will, God's will, we want to bring down to earth. So it's both a looking up and it's a looking around us. And so I hope that as we say this prayer again, that we don't just say the words as if, you know, we're doing something like lifting weights or doing something that we repeat over and over, that these words are deeply powerful. And that it's a way of speaking to God with both our hearts and our minds. And we're shaping ourselves. What Jesus, in Judaism, every human being is considered a vessel of holiness. So how we live our life reflects our beliefs in God, that works and faith go hand in hand. And I think the Lord's Prayer is a perfect example of that message that Jesus taught, rooted in Jewish wisdom, but that Jesus taught to all people. So I'll be talking more about this tomorrow morning when I talk more about the Jewishness of Jesus, and I'll go through each part of Jesus' life, birth, teaching, baptism, and kind of show the Jewish echoes that are embedded at each point. Thank you so much again for having me. It's a great joy and an honor. And I believe our hymn is song number 32.